Welcome to The Mental Breakdown, where we tackle all issues related to mental health, mental illness, parenting, schooling, relationships, and everything in between. While Drs. Bernie and Richard will provide the most up-to-date ideas and perspectives, the information provided in this podcast is not a substitute for medical care. Our goal here at The Mental Breakdown is to provide you with information to help you make your life the best it can be. So without further ado, here's Dr. Bernie and Dr. Richard. Welcome to episode 5 of The Mental Breakdown. I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard.
And today we're going to continue our conversations from last week regarding the current state of affairs in our education system, school and education reform. And we're going to expand it a little bit to include and really emphasize the effect that this is having on students and also about effect it's having on teachers. So just as a quick recap, remember that what we talked about in our last episode, we really spent some time talking about the history of our education system and the purpose, I guess is the best way to say the purpose of our education system. And how it has changed over the course of the past 100 years or so. And I think one of the places to start, as far as this review goes, is to reemphasize the purpose of school. In the early 1900s, you know, the purpose of high school was to prepare students for college. So really the only students that attended high school were those who were intending to go to college. And as Dr. Richard taught us last time, that began to change in the 40s and 50s, and especially as we got into the 60s, with more compulsory education requirements, where students were now required to go to high school for a variety of reasons, not in the least to get some of them out of the workforce so that adults can then go to work and take care of their families.
That's right, Dr. Bernie. I think it's important to remember that we have had compulsory education. All states have had compulsory education in the United States since 1918. But that was education through what we now call middle school. In those years, from 1918 to roughly World War II in the 1940s, most students didn't finish high school. Many students didn't finish high school because it wasn't required in a manufacturing economy. It was in the 1930s and 40s, in response to the Great Depression, that we needed a way to keep students out of the workforce, and one of the ways to do that was to keep them in school longer. So then we get compulsory education laws that go through the age of 16, and that remains in effect today. So yes, you're right, the purpose of schooling reflects what's going on in the culture at the time.
Yeah, so the purpose of school and the way that we're utilizing school has changed, and again, as we learned last week, what we're expecting in schools and what we evaluate in school seem to reflect our social obligations and what's happening in us as a society. Now, bringing up to today, you know, what we learned last week is that much of our current system and our current expectations began back in the 1980s with A Nation at Risk and some of the issues that led to what has eventually become high-stakes testing, grading, evaluating, not just students, but teachers and schools and school systems and principals. And that system has evolved over the past 30 years or so and has gone from what may have been a healthy idea initially in concept to something that has really almost turned into a monster.
I think you make an excellent point there, because when we talk about compulsory education, there are a few countries in the world that try to educate all students, as we do in this country. And the great challenge of the American school system has been not providing a quality education. That's never been a problem. We've been providing a quality education since the Revolution. What our challenge has been is, how do you provide a quality education to all students? That's the great American difference, is we're trying to build a school system that educates all students, whether they want to be there or not, whether they want to be educated, whether they can be educated. is not the issue. They're all there and they're all to be educated. And that's been the great challenge. How do you educate everybody?
Dr. Richard, you must have read the script and outline for today's podcast.
I didn't.
Because that is exactly where our next point is going. And that is, you know, why did we move in this direction? Why did we move into the direction of high stakes testing and placing these expectations and being so concerned when in the first 100 years of education, we weren't so concerned with this? Why all of a sudden are we so focused on some of these performance issues? I mean, let's not forget the fact that our space system, our space exploration system, NASA, so many of our medical engineering and so much of our medical accomplishments came from people who were educated well before we were so concerned with this. So why did we develop this obsession with high-stakes testing and what has become of our system today? Part of that comes from this idea of competition. And you might say, who are we in competition with? Well, everyone, right? In the United States, we sort of thrive and have really benefited from this culture of competition where we always seek to be the best. We want to be top in everything that we do, which drives ingenuity. It drives a lot of invention and discovery. Well, there was this brilliant column written in the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago. It was published on March 26th, and it was entitled something to do with the problems with our obsession with STEM education. STEM, S-T-E-M, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And in this article, the author did a wonderful job of really stepping back and looking at some of these issues and actually provided some thoughts and ideas and perspectives of this that I had not thought of before. For example, you know, he really minimized the discrepancy or the relatively poor comparison scores of U.S. students with students in other countries. He said that there are multiple problems with looking at these international comparisons, least of which is the fact of just what you were saying, that wonderful segue, to the United States is one of the few systems that attempts to educate everyone. Other cultures, other countries, they don't do that. They educate a select few students, and so that's a major difference. Another major difference is we educate on general education, and in other countries, the education system is very focused on one particular track. So if a student is going to be technology-based, all of their education is focused on technology. If they're medical-based, all of their education is focused on medical. They don't get the humanities. They don't get the history. They don't get the arts and some of the other things that we attempt to teach our students here in the United States. And so they spend all of their time focused on some of these areas, whereas our students are much more general. So we have the difference between specialists and generalists. And while we can make arguments about maybe one being better than the other, we can't deny the fact that they are two separate tracks. We have two separate education systems, and we're trying to compare them as though they're the same. Obviously, that will lead to problems. Another big thing that he mentioned, and he specifically mentioned some of the Asian countries, he mentioned that most of their education approaches are two system-based, memorization and test-taking. All of their education system focuses on memorization and how to take tests. So it wouldn't be surprising that some of those students do very, very well when it comes to memorizing basic facts and taking tests. And certainly, Dr. Richard, you know as well as I do, that test-taking skills is a very specific set of skills that you can use to do better on a test than you might otherwise do.
Right. Yeah, I think you make an excellent point here, is that when we compare our students to students from other countries, we have to remember that we're not comparing apples and apples. Those systems function very differently than our system does. Not only do they not have compulsory education, where they want to educate all citizens in the same way. I think they want to educate all citizens. The difference is, are we educating all citizens in the same way? And the second issue is, what are they being trained to do? And you're right, in many Asian, European, but particularly Asian countries, the emphasis is on vast amounts of memorization and test taking. So naturally, those kids are going to be better. Those students are going to be better at those skills than our students are, because our educational system has different goals.
So the moral of the Washington Post column was that we really shouldn't put so much emphasis on these international comparisons. Again, we live in a competitive culture, so we want to be competitive. We want to compare ourselves to other people, to other countries, and we have that drive to be superior. And the Washington Post column ended with what I think was a very nice way to conceptualize it, and that is, you know, despite the fact that we're mid to bottom table on these lists of international comparisons, it is still the United States that drives innovation. It is still the United States that drives ingenuity and research and development. He even quoted some Asian business leaders who feel that their culture, because of the way that they educate their students, it is not as advanced as we are in the United States, because we bring in this general education, this global approach. I think he referenced Steve Jobs in saying that, you know, Apple products are not just technology, they're art, and that you have to marry the two to really make the progress that you hope to make.
You know, Dr. Burney, I think another point to make is that we tend to be very hard and very critical of our educational system. Like, one of the things we have to remember is that students from other countries want to come to the United States to participate in our educational system.
Right.
At the high school level, at the college level, at the university level. People from other countries come here to study. They come here to study mathematics, engineering, medicine, all areas, all disciplines. So we're still the beacon when it comes to education, even though we're very hard on ourselves. And for many critics of the American educational system, it's as though our system is somehow flawed. And yet to the rest of the world, it's a very attractive system and continues to attract citizens from other countries.
Absolutely. So now let's broaden this a little bit, maybe shift a little bit of focus and talk specifically about how the evolution of our system is now affecting students. Dr. Richard and I, we spend a lot of time working with middle and high school students with various forms of anxiety and depression and behavioral issues and things like that, educational problems. And there is no doubt that some of those issues are exacerbated by what's happening in our education system. In fact, I was meeting with a family just the other day, and the father put it to words so well. He was talking about his middle school son, and he said that he was so worried about his son, and that's why he brought him here, because he felt that the school was just beating him up. Within a few weeks of the school system, the boy, who had never had any problems before, had received so many disciplinary referrals for things like not turning in homework or being out of his seat when he wasn't supposed to, that this kid who typically makes AB honor roll was suspended for 3 days. Not because he was hurting anybody or because of anything like that, but because he had a little bit of difficulty controlling some of his impulses. And the father felt like the school was just really beating this kid up and affecting him in that way. So, Dr. Richard, tell us, what do you see in some of your patients? What do you see in some of your kids, your middle school and high school kids that you work with? And what kind of stories are you hearing from them?
I think students at all three levels, elementary, middle school, and high school, are having a very, very difficult time right now. And I think that the difficulties are coming from what we might call educational reforms. We're in the middle of a huge school reform movement. It started about 30 years or so ago. And we're in the middle of a big school reform. And students are being tested. They're being sorted. They're being labeled. with high stakes testing. We're ranking students, we're ranking teachers, we're ranking principals, we're ranking schools. And this is putting an enormous amount of pressure on everybody in the system. Directives, regulations come from either the federal government or from state legislatures, and schools are, they're imposed on schools from the outside, and schools have to make them work. I think the standardized testing movement is just one of those problems. And it puts everybody in the system under an enormous amount of pressure. When I talk to teachers, and by the way, teachers are discouraged from discussing this. In fact, teachers are threatened with sanctions, with punishment, if they do talk publicly about what's going on in public schools. So they're thunderously silent about what's going on. But when you talk to teachers, they will admit to you that most of them are really struggling. There's a lot of depression, there's a lot of anxiety, and that gets passed on to the students. And I think students are feeling the same way. I think the pressure that high stakes testing is putting on kids, I think it's best summarized by a guy by the name of Alfie Cohen, who wrote an article. The title of it was High Stakes Are for Tomatoes. They're putting our students under an enormous amount of pressure. Some of that pressure is okay. I don't think any of us disagree with the fact that we ought to be learning how to deal with some of that stuff. But I think when your entire status as a student or a teacher is distilled into a single measure, I think then we have a problem. Then we create anxiety.
And anxiety is, I think you would agree, anxiety is one of those things that makes us perform poorly on tests.
Right.
So it's almost self-defeating. We're putting this pressure on students to perform well. Meanwhile, the pressure that we're putting them on is going to lead to them performing more poorly.
Right.
And certainly there are subsets of students who are going to succeed no matter what.
Right.
But what we're kind of, what we're talking about is the rest of the students. You know, just a few quick statistics. We were looking this up this morning before we started, just to see if there's any updated information. About 70% of students graduate high school. Of those 70% of students, on the higher end of the estimation, only about 70% go to college.
You mean 70% graduate from high school?
Correct. Of those 70%, only 70% go to college.
Okay.
If we do all the math, what that means is about 50% of students go to college.
So 50% of all students who graduate from high school.
No, 50% of all students.
50% of all students, right, end up going to college.
Right. So every student that we have.
So the important question then becomes, of that 50%, that's how many go to college.
Correct.
How many complete college?
Only 57% of the people who go to college graduate college. So again, if we do all of the math, what that means is of all students out there, only about 30% get a high school, college degree.
Okay, so even though 50 or 60% go to college, only about half of that number complete college.
Correct.
Okay.
So if we break it all the way down, of all of the students, only about 30% of students complete a college degree.
Roughly 1 in 3 students who start high school will end up getting a college degree.
Right.
Okay.
All right. Now, let's take that, the fact that only about a third of students will get a college degree.
Okay.
Let's look at high school expectations. Look this up this morning.
So you're saying, let's take all these kids and see what they're being asked to do in high school.
Right.
Okay, given that only 1 out of 3 are going to go to college, what are we asking them to do while they're in high school?
Right.
Got it. Okay.
If a student enters high school this year, in ninth grade in the 2014-2015 school year, to graduate in Florida, among other things, they have to pass an algebra end of course exam, they have to pass a geometry end of course exam, they have to take a statistics, or as it says, equally rigorous mathematics course, which could be, I suppose, algebra 2. They don't have to pass an EOC for that, but they have to take the course. They have to pass the biology end of course exam. They have to take either chemistry or physics. They have to pass a U.S. history end of course exam. And they have to take either an advanced placement, an international baccalaureate, or a dual enrollment course to graduate.
Wait a minute. if those of you who have something to write with, you really ought to write this stuff down. So what we're saying is, or what you just said was, they have to pass an end of course. It's called EOC, end of course exam. And this is what you have to understand. You can take an entire year's worth of Algebra 1, and you can pass every test the teacher gives you.
Right.
But if you fail the end of course exam, which is not built by the teacher, by the way, right?
Right.
Okay, so this other exam that comes from somewhere else, in Tallahassee or somewhere, if you don't pass that end of course exam, you do not pass the course.
Correct.
And what? And so how many so you have to pass end of course exams in Algebra 1.
Algebra 1, Geometry, Biology 1, and U.S. History.
So four courses. You have to take those courses, pass the course, and pass the end of course exam, or you don't get a high school diploma.
Correct.
Okay.
So, and accompanying that, all students to get a standard high school diploma. Now, this isn't a special diploma that is for college preparatory, or this isn't some fancy-dancy high school diploma. This is a standard Florida high school diploma. In addition to all of that, you have to take a course that, for lack of a better word, is a college-level course, either a dual enrollment course, which means dual enrollment with a college, a community college or state college, an advanced placement course, which is a course that you will also take an exam, the AP exam, or an international baccalaureate or IB course.
Okay.
So you have to take this course, which I think everyone would admit is very stringent. Those are tough, tough courses. You have to take one of those to get a standard diploma in Florida.
So that would be the fifth course then.
Correct.
The fifth kind of college,
right,
preparatory kind of course.
Correct.
All students have to do that.
Correct.
In order to get a high school diploma.
And I didn't mention in this list, the big things I didn't mention was you have to do 2 years in foreign language, and you have to do four English courses. And there's another test, an 11th grade test. I forget the name of it, but there's an 11th grade test that you have to take and you have to pass. So all of this is driven by what we've mentioned before, Common Core. The idea is that we will have these level of expectations. Students will pass them and they will demonstrate their understanding and awareness and learning of these by passing these exams and taking these courses and successfully completing them. So for a third of the students who we know are going to go to college and complete a college education, 100% of students are expected to meet these standards.
So despite what their plans are after high school, if they're in high school, they must take these college preparatory courses.
Correct.
Okay. I'm having a hard time following this, but I'm going to try to keep up.
It's dense. And imagine being the student having to take these courses.
Well, I'm wondering about all those. I mean, there are students who, if they have trouble learning 5th or 6th or 7th or 8th grade math, how in the world are they going to pass a course in Algebra 1, let alone Algebra 2? How do they do that? I mean, I don't know.
Well, remember, for those of you who are interested in this kind of thing, Dr. Richard was my pre-doctoral supervisor, and we worked in the school system here in Central Florida. And one of the first things that we were both sort of taken aback by, and this was in the early 2000s, was when a 4th grade teacher told us that in order to stay on track for what was then the state testing, for her to stay on track in mathematics, she would have to teach a new math skill every day.
Right.
Now, that was 13 years ago. The standards have only gotten more and more challenging. So the issue is, one of the issues is, the teachers cannot pause. There is no room for hesitation. Because if the teacher has any hope of helping the students have the skills and abilities that they need to pass these courses and to meet the expectations, they have to remain on track. Common Core, in fact, requires every teacher, even at different schools, to be teaching the same material on the same day and in some cases, in the same way. So that if a student changed from one school on one side of the county, and the family moved and he became enrolled in another school on the other side of the county, he would flow right into the course without any delays or any problems because they should be on the same page on the same days. In theory, I suppose, in a vacuum, there is nothing wrong with that plan. It's great.
But it raises the issue, the obvious issue of whose pace
absolutely
are we working at? Are we working at the pace of the highest achieving students? Are we somehow in the middle? Are we working at the pace of the lowest achieving students? And if you're not, what happens to those kids who can't keep up every day? If the expectation is that each kid will learn a certain amount of material every day, what about those kids who don't, who can't do that? What happens to them in Common Core? Do we know?
No.
I don't know.
We don't know what happens to them except the fact that they're probably going to have difficulty meeting the expectations necessary for graduation and getting the standard diplomas. And so we're going to continue to have those problems. And the concern that I have, and you know, there aren't any statistics yet to back this up, but the concern that I have is that that percentage that I gave earlier of 70% of students graduating high school, that number is going to go down. That it's going to be more and more difficult for students to graduate high school, and the number of students who complete is going to drop.
Well, you know, so we're sort of back to where we started, because one of the things we said early in this podcast was the challenge in the American educational system has been, how do you educate everybody? Well, now Common Core comes in and said, this is how we're going to educate everybody. But everybody can't keep up.
Right.
I mean, not every kid. If you have a classroom of 20 kids, some are going to be able to do more than Common Core and some are going to be able to do less than Common Core. But some kids simply aren't going to be able to keep up.
Right.
So Common Core isn't going to solve the problem of what do you do with those kids who can't keep up with Common Core. We're still going to have those kids.
Right.
And it goes back to... But now, they're not going to get a high school diploma.
Right.
Okay.
And it goes back to your issue of whose pace do we follow?
Right.
If we followed the students who needed more time, what does that do for the students who don't need more time?
And then that school won't keep up with the curriculum.
Correct.
They're going to start falling behind. And the idea with Common Core is everybody is doing the same lesson on the same day.
Right.
Okay.
And this is, you know, this isn't a new problem.
Right.
You know,
right.
In any industry, in any situation, when we attempt to implement a standard that is the same for everyone, we run into problems because it doesn't take into account individual differences, individual variability.
Right.
And we're left with a situation where some are going to do well, some are going to excel, some are really going to struggle. And you know, I think that it takes me back to what we talked about last time with No Child Left Behind. We know it was a failure,
but No Child Left Behind was one of those things that said, this is how we're going to close the achievement gap.
Right.
This is how we're going to get all kids to grade level. That's why we had it.
Okay. Yeah. And the issue is that once again, it did not take into account individual variability.
It said when it was signed into law in 2001, it said by 2014, all students will be reading proficiently or near grade level, or that this was going to solve the problem, that we were going to test kids and make sure that they were keeping up. And if they weren't keeping up, we were going to give them the skills that they needed. And this would bring those low achieving students up and finally solve the problem of what do you do about underperforming students.
Right.
And it's been a failure.
And there's one word in that made it a failure, and it was the word all.
Oh, right.
The idea was that all students were going to be able to do that. And we know, as we said last week, statistically, that is impossible. We know that there are biological bases for dyslexia. There are neuropsychological events and abnormalities that prohibit some people from gaining these skills, at least at a level of proficiency.
Right.
So to work under the delusion that we're going to overcome that.
Right. And there are also non-educational factors that mitigate it. There's poverty, there's family factors, there's lack of motivation. There are many other factors. There are places where I mean, we all know there are families where education simply isn't valued, where kids don't go to school regularly, where they don't do their homework, where they don't respect their teachers. Those are non-education factors, but they also mitigate against every child being at a certain standard. So some are educational, some are non-educational factors, but not everybody is at the same place every day.
Absolutely. So with all of this in mind, you know, going back to where we started, and that is, what effect does this have on the student? You know, there are many students that I meet with and work with to help them overcome the depression that comes about with not being able to succeed at the level that they would like or that they're expected to succeed, or the anxiety that they have because they know going into these situations they are not going to be able to perform at a level that they would like to perform, or worse yet, you know, the stress of knowing that they are going to fail to meet the expectations of their teachers and their parents and their administrators. This absolutely increases the prevalence of anxiety, increases the prevalence of depression. And we talked a little bit about ADHD last week, but especially at the younger ages, it increases the symptoms that look like ADHD. Because, you know, if a student's having a hard time keeping up with a new math skill every day, what is he going to be doing instead? He's going to be off task. He's going to be distracted. He's going to be fidgeting with things. And it's going to make the teacher say, oh, this kid must have ADHD.
So the thought just occurred to me as you're talking, and I'm sorry for interrupting, but the thought just occurred to me that the problem is not just that tests create anxiety, but there's an even larger problem. That if every student has to keep up every day, then somebody, and that somebody would be parents and teachers, must put pressure on that child every day.
Every day.
So it's not just that testing, high stakes testing, creates anxiety, but in fact, this anxiety exists every day. You know, it's not good enough that you do your algebra homework. You have to now be prepared for that end of course exam. So this is a pressure cooker all year long.
All year.
And then it heightens during testing time. Because correct. Now, if you don't pass that test, you don't get a high school diploma.
Right. So we are certainly talking, I like how you put it, a pressure cooker. We are definitely talking about those types of situations. And, you know, some of the students that I've worked with, I've gone to their schools, and, you know, you walk into the classroom, and first day of school, you walk in and there's posters on the wall promoting and getting ready. Hey, FCAT is coming up. FCAT is the Florida Comprehensive Assessment Test or Comprehensive Achievement Test. But there's posters on the wall saying, trying to make it like this is a cheery thing. Hey, here we go. Meanwhile, for students, it creates terror. They're scared to death about what's going to happen because students hear the stories of mm-hmm. being retained because you didn't do well on the test.
Put in special classes. They're put in remedial classes.
Right.
They lose their electives.
Right.
So that they can go into two remedial classes.
Right.
So instead of taking PE and something else, they're put into these two remedial classes.
Right. If a student doesn't do well on a statewide achievement test in reading, mm-hmm. the next year they will be in a course called intensive reading.
Right.
So for middle and high school students, what that means is they lose an elective. Lose something that would otherwise keep them engaged and interested in being at school.
And they get the public embarrassment of having to go to the special class.
Right.
Okay.
It's a double whammy.
Okay.
So this absolutely has an impact on the students and does much more than, you know, put pressure on them to perform well. It puts pressure on them that they oftentimes can't overcome and creates other problems. Now, transitioning just a little bit, let's talk about who's putting the pressure on the students, and that's the teachers. There was an article written that was published just a couple days ago from a teacher who is planning to, this is actually going to be her last year mm-hmm. teaching. She has been teaching for 6 years, and she's calling it quits. She says that she can't handle it anymore, and it was a very, very raw and emotional expression of some of the frustrations that she has felt and how, in her words, being a teacher has changed who she is. While she was once this caring, enthusiastic person, she found herself often saying things and doing things that sometimes demeaned her students, attempting to put her students below her, because if the students didn't try as hard as they could, that reflected on her.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of pressure to put on a teacher.
So she was feeling pressure from above, and she passed that pressure on to her students.
Right.
And in doing so, changed how she treats people.
Correct.
Okay.
And she mentioned a specific situation where one of her students called her out on it. Called her out on it. She was a teacher in high school, and she called the students children. And one of the students said, "Well, why do you call us children?" And another student said, "Well, she does that to make herself better than us, make herself, put her above us."
Mm-hmm.
And she admits that was likely the more or less subconscious cause for that. So this high stakes testing, the expectations that we have right now, for all the effects that it has on the students, it has equal effects on the teachers. Teachers are stressed. If there's two groups of people who have entered into the need for mental health services the most, it's students and teachers.
Mm-hmm.
We see a large number of teachers for mental health treatment because they are so stressed and so overwhelmed with the expectations of the school year, the expectations from their administrators, the expectations from the school system, and it's sometimes too much for them to manage. Imagine being someone who is responsible for teaching a group of students who may or may not have any interest in learning what you're attempting to teach them, but yet your performance is going to be evaluated by their scores on a test. Man, that would be a job that you would really have to pay me a lot of money to do.
They have no control over the process, but they're being held responsible. They're being held accountable.
Right.
It would when be, they have no control.
It would be like, I'm going to hold you responsible for building a car, but you have no say in the materials that I give you. So I'll bring you...
I can't supervise the workers.
Right.
But I'm responsible for what they build.
Absolutely. Okay. So I'm going to bring you a couple reams of paper and some glue, and I want you to build me a car out of that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm holding you to a level of expectation, and you have no control over the process. So, it's unfair at the most basic side, and it's almost punitive on the other end. Most teachers go into the field of education with a drive to educate students, but then they're punished if they don't meet some level of standards that are put out there for them. You know, teachers, I always have had an issue with that old adage, you know, those who do.
Those who can do.
Those who can't teach. To me, that is a horribly untrue statement. If you really want to see how well you understand something, teach it to someone. If you understand something, you have to understand it in a very intimate way to be able to teach somebody else how to then use it. I feel like I know algebra pretty well. If you give me an algebraic equation, I can work through it and solve it. But when I have to teach my son how to do algebra, all of my skills are taxed because I just want to say, you just do it like this. And he will say that word that terrifies us all, why? And I have no idea why. I just know that that's what you do. Teachers know why.
Right.
And that's what they're working to teach their students. Mm-hmm. And so teachers, and Dr. Richard, you and I are both university and college instructors. It's a challenge to teach something unless you have that intimate knowledge of it.
Right. Right.
So that adage, there's absolutely nothing true about that adage.
Mm-hmm.
Teachers know, and teachers can do, but they're choosing to share their knowledge with someone else and hopefully help foster a love for education in students so that they will continue and they will continue to be innovative and creative and all of those things. So teachers are under a tremendous amount of stress. pressure is placed on them from a variety of sources. And, you know, I think that it's just important that we keep that in mind as parents and as fellow educators when we say, you know, well, it's your job to teach them. What that means is it's your job to try to get these children enthusiastic about something that they may have no interest in. And let's just not minimize that and make it out that that's something simple to do.
So as I listen to this, I'm thinking, so here are these teachers. What they're being told is they have to accomplish a certain topic. They have to cover a certain amount of material every day to students who may or may not be able to understand it.
Right.
Because we're saying that many won't, 20 or 30% won't, because we know that only about 80 or 85% of kids can handle a grade level curriculum at some level. 10 to 20% are unable to. But regardless of those statistics, a teacher is expected to succeed with all of her students.
Right.
And if she doesn't, there will be consequences.
Correct.
Okay. That's pressure.
A lot of pressure.
That's an enormous amount of pressure because she doesn't have complete control over these kids. They live in homes. They have friends. They have other activities. There's something other than school going on in their lives.
Right.
But she has no control over those other things. She only has control over what she does for that 50 minutes that she has them.
Right.
Okay. And she controls what she can do. She can't control what they do.
Right.
She can present the material, but if a student chooses not to learn it, there's really nothing she can do about that.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And let's, you know, if we go to, there is a website, get2core.org, get2core.org. There's a paper published there that says that estimates that only 25% of high school graduates are prepared for college. Okay, that's
well,
it.
Well, but that's about, that's one third again.
Right.
The group that ends up graduating is that 25%.
Right.
Okay.
So once again, putting all this together, we have teachers under tremendous stress to teach every student, prepare every student, 100% of students, for college based upon the graduation expectations. We want, you know, our goal is for every student to graduate high school.
Right.
To graduate high school, you have to be college ready.
Mm-hmm.
When we know that in the best of times, only a third are going to be college ready to the point where they will end up graduating college. So it's, again, almost delusional.
The craziness is that we know that only one out of three are ready, and yet the entire curriculum is designed to prepare all of them for college.
Right.
Okay.
So, and that, I think that brings us very nicely to what should be our last point for this podcast, and that is, what the heck are we doing?
What are we doing? I like, what are we doing? You mean, what are we doing with the 70%?
Right.
Who are not going to college or are not planning to go to college or are unable to go to college.
Right. I had a wonderful conversation with another person the other day talking about, and he's a business owner, and he made the comment that he doesn't hire anyone that doesn't have a college degree. And I found that interesting. And I asked him why. And he said that from his experience, people with a college degree are the most likely people to have the skills needed to be successful. And I started thinking about that, and it fits very well with what we're talking about. And that is, we are working so hard, if we think, restrict our conversation to that 70% who are not going to graduate college, we are working so hard to try to pressure them, to push them into something that they're not going to do, instead of giving them the skills and attributes necessary to be successful in life, to be successful in business, to be successful in a trade. We're trying to teach them algebra, for goodness sakes, and they could care less. They're going to end up working at a fast food restaurant or at a store. They may work in, you know, in a variety of contexts because that's where their interest is or because that's where they want to be. Mm-hmm. But we're not preparing them for real life. We're not providing them with the skills, the time management skills, the organizational skills. We're leaving all of that behind and saying, well, you should have that. Those are skills that you should have. But we're not teaching them those things. So these kids end up either, you know, some of them graduate high school but then don't go to college. And some of them don't even graduate high school, but they don't have the skills necessary to be successful in life.
Right.
And we really need to shift that paradigm a little bit. Some other countries, I think, have it right. And that is, we make decisions. If we look at the graduation requirements, we will know in ninth grade if a student is going to meet those expectations.
That's true.
If a student cannot make it through algebra in ninth grade, the likelihood of him meeting all of these expectations is pretty small.
That's true. You're going to know by ninth grade, because in eighth and ninth grade, that student would have taken those, probably algebra, at least algebra one, and maybe a biology course.
Right.
So they will have already gotten exposed. And if they don't pass those end of course exams, there's a very good likelihood that they're not going to finish high school.
Right.
But there's no alternative for them.
No alternative.
Got it.
Okay. So why don't we create a system? And maybe this is some stuff we should talk to our politicians and really have a public forum discussion about. Why don't we create a system where with these students that we know are not going to be very likely to meet this expectations for graduation, for whatever reason, because of lack of interest or because of disability, create a system that then provides those students with skills, with abilities that's going to make them successful in life.
So you're talking about a system that's comparable to the European system.
Correct.
For example, part of my family lives in Germany. And in the German system, I think there's a test that students take in about eighth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And those students who pass the test go on to, I think it's called Gymnasium, which is the college preparatory program. And if they don't, they go to another place, another kind of school, to prepare them for some trade.
Right.
So they're using a test to separate the two. But in our country, we have this concept of equality of opportunity. We want to provide everybody with the opportunity. But in fact, we are using tests to separate these kids.
Right.
It's just we're not doing it overtly like they are in Europe.
Right. We're being very sneaky about it. And I think that the...
And with all the pressure that comes with it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And not just the pressure. And what terrifies me for some of these students is not just the pressure, but it's the failure. When they fail...
That's right.
That will stick with them.
So in the German system, both succeed. In our system, one out of three succeeds, and two out of three are sort of consigned to failure.
Right.
In a way.
Right.
Okay.
In some ways. So we had a system like this before. Things, you know, early on in our education system, we were sort of on tracks like what we're talking about. And the problem is...
When you say on track, you meant that only certain students went on to college.
Right.
Others
right.
dropped out.
And did other things.
But they were dropping out in a manufacturing economy.
Right.
So that if they dropped out, they could go into steel mills or fabrication mills or car companies and still make a good middle class living.
But for goodness sakes, we don't even have apprenticeships anymore. Remember, back then we had apprenticeships so that if you wanted to be a plumber, you left high school and you went and you became an apprentice with a plumber, and that gave you the skills and everything. I mean, we have licenses for everything now. And so, you know, you can't just be an apprentice and proceed that way. You have to do so many other things. So we've just sort of educationalized everything. So you have to have all these formal...
So this whole idea about everybody has to go to college.
Right.
Either a community college or a local. Somehow you have to go to some post-secondary college.
Right.
Okay.
And so we've had some of this stuff before. And so I think that, you know, as we're thinking about this, what we have to do is, you know, in America, and I keep sort of referring to it that way, we are very all or nothing. We have such a hard time, and it's sort of the underlying theme with everything that we've talked about. You know, every kid has to be able to do these things in our mindset. We are all or nothing when it comes to some of these things, and we have to build in some flexibility with this. You know, you imagine the student, you know, in the German system who doesn't pass the test, but is a very hard worker and really would like to, you know, give it a, you know, the best shot that he can to try to go to college, if they recognize the limitations or the consequences of failure, mm-hmm. give him a shot.
Right. Let him try.
Let him try. And I think that right. we have some hesitations here in trying to shift into those kinds of, you know, let's make a decision and have a discussion about it. We like to be black and white and say, well, this is going to happen or this is going to happen. When, you know, obviously in life, there's a lot of gray area.
And so as we move forward, right now what we're facing is a large number of students are not going to get an education that will prepare them for college.
Right. Or for life.
For life. So the question you're raising is, okay, let's keep Common Core. Let's keep all these standards. Let's keep the college prep for those 30%.
Right.
What you're suggesting is we need to get something in place for the 70% who aren't.
We have to have something for them.
Okay.
You do them as well. We have a large portion of our practice here is in working through the court system and through the DCF system and legal system. I'm taken aback by the percentage of people who didn't graduate high school and have just been unable to maintain employment.
They're unemployable. They're unemployable.
Because they don't have the skills.
I have a young man in his 20s now who completed high school, he completed coursework, but he didn't pass the 10th grade FCAT.
Right.
And therefore does not have a high school diploma.
Right.
Despite the fact that he went to high school, graduated from high school, doesn't have a high school diploma. He's had a terrible time finding it. It's taken him years to find a job. He has no training.
Right.
And he's going to be underemployed. He's going to be at an entry-level position most of his life.
Right. And if we just shifted our perspective just a little bit and said and recognized, and I think that maybe that's the problem that we have, is just accepting the fact that this is how it is. Accepting the fact that this system is not going to work for everyone.
So this kid, when he didn't pass that test in 10th grade, he would have had 2 years to get trained to do something.
To do something.
As it was, he was continuing to take college preparatory courses, and he was never going to be able to go to college.
Right. And sort of the last example is one to sort of illustrate when this system can work. Our vocational schools. Mm-hmm. Now, our vocational schools oftentimes do not get the credit that they deserve.
Right.
I had a student that I was working with. He was 10th grade, hated school, despised school. And so I sat with him and we talked about it and we came up with a plan because he wanted to be a welder. That's what he wanted to do. More specifically, he loved scuba dive, so he wanted to be an underwater welder. Well, for those of you who don't know, underwater welding is a very lucrative job.
Right.
You know, straight out, you can start out at over $100,000 a year in some places. Now, the amount of time that you can work, the length of time that you can work in your life is shorter because of the toll it takes on your body. But the opportunities, if you get the right jobs, are great. What he did was, in 11th grade, he left high school. At the start of 11th grade, he left high school, went into the trade school. He really only earned maybe a GED because he didn't do any of the foreign language stuff. He would not have met any of these expectations for high school graduation. But while he was getting his GED, he got certified in 4 or 5 areas of welding. So when he graduated high school, he had a set of skills and had connections through the trade school to get a job. And so he left high school with a decent paying job and with the opportunity to go on and do some of the other things that he wanted to do. If his parents would have been some of those parents who force him to stay in school, reject the idea of a trade school, and made him say that, I have no doubt that he would have dropped out of school and wouldn't have accomplished any of that. But because he did the track that he did, he became much more successful and had a much more likelihood of being a productive member of society, which is what we always want.
But in most of the cities where I have lived, in the 5 or 6 places I've lived in my life, the technical schools, the trade schools, never have enough places for all the kids who could use them.
Right. And it's often seen as Secondary.
Right.
Yeah. So,
or second class.
Right.
Yeah.
So we have to rethink our model. And if you're listening to this podcast, you know, we encourage you. We want to hear from you because we want this discussion to happen. We want to talk about this more. We want more people to talk about this so that we can make some positive changes in our society, in our children's lives, to make them more successful and to make them more likely to succeed after they finish their education. Anything else you wanted to add before we wrap up?
Nope, that's it.
All right. Well, thank you guys for listening. We'll definitely be monitoring to if anybody emails or has any questions, we will always respond to you. And we'd love ideas for future topics that you'd like for us to discuss. So until next time, I'm Dr. Bernie.
I'm Dr. Richard.
And stay happy and healthy.
Thank you for listening to The Mental Breakdown. If you want more information, you can check out our website at www.pacflorida.com. The Mental Breakdown is sponsored in part by theledger.com, where you can read our weekly column in the Life section. Our podcasts are available for download on iTunes, and you can follow us on our YouTube channel and Facebook. We would love to hear from you, so feel free to send us messages either through our website or on Facebook. You can send us questions or topics you would like for us to address on future podcasts. Drs. Bernie and Richard are available for workshops, so you can contact us for more information. Thank you for listening, and until next time, stay mentally healthy.